Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, zip up your leather pants, slap on the clown paint, and don't forget to eat something light as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, anomalies, and legends. I am one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined today by my pal, Mark Matzke.
Hello there.
And we have just returned from a wild expedition, cryptozoological expedition, into the frigid north, Maine. Eastern coast, northern east coast of the United States, the glorious state of Maine. My second time being up there. No, third time. And I drove through Hartford on the way up, Hartford, Connecticut. And I have fond memories of Hartford, Connecticut because of the fact that it's where the very first time I ever had tricolored nachos.
Where was that? Do you remember?
It was a sports bar that was, so our hotel, this was when I was super, I was like probably 12 years old, and I'm glad that this is becoming a story that I'm regaling our audience with now. I was like 12 years old. We were doing some sort of like book symposium or something there for my parents' store, and we were staying in a hotel that was attached to the hockey stadium, because the Hartford, is it the Whalers that are, it's the hockey, whatever the Hartford hockey team is. I think it's the Whalers, but they, which probably has changed by now, right?
I would think
that that's somehow not permitted. Anyway, I'm pretty sure that it was the Hartford Whalers.
Whale huggers.
Yeah, whale well. Huggers. But we walked across the bridge into the stadium, and there was like a sports bar on the second floor. And at this time in my life, my parents and I always used to watch sports. So like Damon's, we went to Damon's all the time, stuff like that. Anyway, I just remember being really thrilled about the tricolored nachos. So yeah, so we just got back from Maine, where we were part of the International Cryptozoology Conference, Museum Conference. Their Facebook page says Museum Conference, but everything there, I think, just said conference.
Yeah, that's a lot to say at any one time.
Should I talk about the Sleepy Hollow thing?
Yeah. Okay, chronologically, so, I think
that makes sense. So we're going to talk about the trip up, and then we're going to recap the conference a little bit. And then Mark's actually going to do sort of a recap of his presentation that he did on Friday night, which was one of the highlights for me, partially because I didn't really get to hear anything else.
That's good. Yeah.
So we left on Wednesday. Myself and Adrian and our little dude, and we drove to Sleepy Hollow, in New York. So for those, unfamiliar with the fact that I'm a huge fan of that story. I'm a huge fan of that story. The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. So this was like something I've always wanted to go to Sleepy Hollow, and you've never been.
Never been. Okay. No.
And we didn't know what to expect. I actually expected sort of like a Zor Village style thing. For Zor Village is this historically preserved village like 5 minutes from where I grew up. We used to walk over to Zor Village and have breakfast and stuff. So it looks like you step back into the 1700s, 1800s. And that was kind of what I was expecting, because everything I had read about Sleepy Hollow was that it was this very like historic place. It's not necessarily like that at all. And like our first night there, we actually had kind of decided we weren't going to stick around the next day, which originally was going to be like a 2-day trip. But But just because it just didn't look like there was enough to do to really like hold our attention the next day. But we ended up staying both days, and we had a blast there. Like but also like just the history of the place is present. Once you just had to look for it. That's the thing I wasn't expecting. I wasn't expecting like a suburb of New York City either, which it is. Like driving in, we came over the Tappan Zee Bridge, and you could see Manhattan. Like you can see the skyline from the river. Which is actually like one of the cooler things, because I went back and watched the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the Disney cartoon, while we were there. And it opens with like a map of the Hudson River Valley, and it starts in New York City and then moves up the river and ends at Sleepy Hollow. Mm-hmm. And when you're actually driving over the bridge and you can see New York City, it's there's something really like geek cool about that for someone that loves that movie, because I was raised on that Disney cartoon. Mm-hmm. The next day we went to the first night there, we really just ate dinner and then went back to our hotel and crashed because we were pretty exhausted by then. But the next day we woke up early and went for a walk and wound up at a huge estate called Lyndhurst, which is like right down the road from Sleepy Hollow. That's the other thing about this area, is that the villages are all kind of connected. Like, you can't tell you're leaving one village and going into the next. And that was part of our problem when we first got there, because we didn't realize we were still in Tarrytown. We thought we were in Sleepy Hollow. So Tarrytown, Sleepy Hollow, and a little village called Irvington, which is where Washington Irving actually lived, are all connected. And my favorite's actually probably Irvington. It's set on a hill, like this real steep hill that runs down to the Hudson River. And we ate there on Tommy's birthday and had a really nice time. But we got to see Washington Irving's estate from a distance, Sunnyside. And then probably the highlight of the whole thing was the old Dutch church, which is like one of the oldest remaining churches in America. It was built in the late 1600s. And there's people buried in that cemetery that were born in the 1600s, which is pretty insane once you're actually witnessing that. But for like fans of the paranormal and the weird, there is, I'm trying to, so I bought a book that's coming the next few days that digs into whether or not there was any historical accuracy behind the legend itself, like the legend of the Headless Horseman. And I'm actually hoping we could do like maybe a full episode and interview the guy that wrote this book that I'm buying. But basically, like, you totally understand once you're there and you are at the Dutch church, all of a sudden you're in the legend of Sleepy Hollow, because the church is still there. This cemetery is one of I hate to use the word creepy, because in a way it kind of demeans it, because it's so historically relevant and really, really interesting and so like very sobering too, because you're looking at graves of like children and parents that died, you know, like there were a lot of graves of children in the cemetery. But it's also like creepy and cool, like spooky cool. And right at the entrance to the cemetery, there's a big plaque that tells you about the legend of the Headless Horseman and like how he supposedly rises from his grave, which is in the cemetery, and you know, rides out of the cemetery. And what's really cool is geographically, once you're in that place, you understand the geography of this, of Irving's story of the legend of Sleepy Hollow, because right across, so you go up this little hill that would be on the right of the road that we came in on. You go up this hill and you're in the old Dutch church and the old Dutch church burying grounds, which is what they actually call the cemetery. And on the left, set back near the Hudson River, is Philipsburg Manor, which I need to read the story again, but I'm pretty sure Philipsburg is where the party is set, where Ichabod was visiting the night that he leaves and starts riding out, and the Headless Horseman actually pays him a visit. And so, like, once you're looking at these places, like, all of a sudden the story comes to life in front of you. It's really weird because the bridge is also there. The bridge is right outside of the cemetery. So it would make sense, like, Ichabod leaves this party, comes up their drive, and then makes a right onto the road that's there now, which, and the bridge is supposedly the bridge that the one in the story used to be this old covered bridge. Now it's like a modern four-lane bridge or something. It's kind of depressing, but the headless horseman rise from his grave and then come out down the hill toward Ichabod as he's leaving, and then chase him across that bridge. It's just weird because like the whole thing is suddenly it, everything gets solidified in your head for like where each thing would have been. And I've never had that experience with a fictional story where it's a fictional story, but everything is right there. Like everything is real. So that's what's really interesting about like whether or not there is an actual headless horseman legend. Cause I'm supposedly like Irving made that up, right? Like it was a fictional legend, but I bought this book because it seems to hint at the fact that there may have been a legend that existed before Irving made that up. And he might've based his book on the actual legend. And we found like Katrina Van Tassel's grave. The Van Tassels are buried there. There's other characters that are named in the book that are buried there. Unfortunately, we only had like 15 minutes at the actual cemetery because Tommy took a super long nap and we didn't get over there till late. But yeah, it was really, really cool. One of the better vacations we've gone on, like as a family. I want to go back there and spend hours in that cemetery. And I didn't get to go into the church because it was locked up. But at Halloween, the headless horseman comes out of the cemetery.
Oh,
rides,
wow.
Rides a horse.
No kidding.
Rides a horse down through the cemetery and out of the, and does like basically retraces the ride. So I would like to go back at Halloween because supposedly it's really cool at that time of year. It's definitely it's a small town monsters movie waiting to happen. I just don't know if, I mean, it's like my dream movie now. Mm-hmm. Like that's the movie I want to make. It's because you've got this like suburb built up around this very historic area as well. And they seem to be trying to embrace the legend, but not fully aware of how to do it. Like there's no statue of like the headless horseman. There's a sculpture outside of the old Dutch church. That's kind of cool, but they don't seem to like get how to do it. You know, there should be like a museum.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was anything.
No, I mean, not that we found that would be. Now, I think that there might be some stuff at Phillipsburg. Like, there's a museum at Phillipsburg. We didn't get to go in. But, I mean, regardless, there should be something that's strictly the legend of Sleepy Hollow. You know, like, that would go into the why Irving wrote it and, you know, like, preserve some of the aspects of that book and what inspired it and things like that. So, but we had a great time. And it's a really cool place. And if you're in that area traveling or you live in that area and you haven't gone, I really recommend it. And I had one of the best hamburgers I've ever had in my life. I had this burger at this, I can't even remember the name of the restaurant either, but strongly recommend a visit to Sleepy Hollow. And we're going to go back. I would actually love to go back this Halloween. I might try.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. We, our only tale of getting there is we went across southern Vermont, and it's a little longer to go that way, but we wanted to see the mountains and stuff. And we just happened upon a little place called the Southern Vermont Natural History Museum, which ended up being really the taxidermed collection of one man who did all of these birds and ducks and gulls, Bigfoot, chupacabra.
It was right there in front of us.
Yeah. But there was a catamount or a mountain lion that they did have there that was pretty cool. And that's awesome. University of Vermont's mascot is a catamount. Mm. So that was neat. It was one of those things that you just stumble on, and they even build themselves as the best kept secret of Highway 9 or something like that. And it's right at the apex of this ridge called Hogback Ridge. And it was a clear day, and that they claim you could see into New Hampshire and some other state. It was just really, it's a beautiful place.
Did you get a Pacific Northwest vibe out there? Is it like distinctly its own? There were times when I was there where I got a PNW vibe. It's just on a smaller.
Yeah. Especially through the Green Mountain portion of Vermont, mm-hmm. where it's real rocky and, mountainous in places. New Hampshire, southern New Hampshire sort of settles down a little bit. And it's just more suburban and natural, yeah. You know, just sort of average America in many ways. You have to go north, I guess.
The weirdest thing about that area, like the New England area and everything, is no matter where you are, you feel like you're submerged in history.
Yes.
Like there's these, like just driving along the highway, there's these like stone walls that follow the highways, back in the woods, like far back in the woods. You can see them off the side of the highway. I don't know why those are there or where they came from, but you would assume they're very old, because I don't know why you would just build them in the woods like that. But no matter where you go, it seems like you're kind of covered in history. And then you get to something like that old Dutch church. But yeah, we were there for the International Cryptozoology Museum, put on by Lauren Coleman and Jenny Coleman and Jeff Muse and the rest of the fine folks, Gene Tewksbury, the fine folks from the International Cryptozoology Museum. This was my second time going. Was your second time? Or
yeah, third? Second.
Second time. And the last time we went was in 2017, right after the Mothman of Point Pleasant came out. We actually showed the Mothman of Point Pleasant and had a really cool time. We got to meet Steve Bissett. He wasn't there this time, but we got to meet Steve Bissett. We had a great time in 2017. Mark is going to take over on this conference recap, though, because like I was running a table, and then also we had our two-year-old with us, and so there was a lot of wrangling going on with Tommy. I'm trying to think if there's any... The Terror in the Skies premiere happened on Saturday night, and that was the first time we've been able to show the movie anywhere. And we had a really cool sound system and a screen that was put together by the guys from Mandate 33, which is... I'm not sure if it's on, I think Mandate 33 is on YouTube, but either way, like if you can find these dudes, check out their work. Cause they submitted one of their movies, Wazooie Man, which is like a short look at a local legend, in Montana or Colorado. It's Colorado. That people, especially listeners of our show, would enjoy, their stuff. But so they put together this really cool screen sound system and everything. Shout out to those guys. Oh, one other, Alexander Petikov was there too.
Yeah.
So like Alexander, is a part of the STM family, having directed On the Trail of Champ. So that was cool too. But yeah, the screening was really, fun. It seemed like the response to it was great. And this was the first time it's screened anywhere. So it was the largest audience too, that's seen it at one time so far. And that was like rewarding to me, because it seemed like people enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's something really cool about watching it with Lauren Coleman, who's featured in it, mm-hmm. you know, and I have a picture of the premiere from, you know, showing the title card, and in the foreground you can see, if you know who you're looking at, there's Lauren Coleman sitting there watching it.
So I didn't even realize
that. Yeah, it's pretty cool. And Jenny, he and Jenny were sitting right next to each other. And once in a while, after he would talk, she would kind of lean in and say something to him. It was just really fun to watch that part of it, because, you know, they were having their own personal reaction to the finished product, which was really cool.
Cool. Yeah, it was a fun time. And we did a Q&A afterward that lasted about 5 seconds. it was the antithesis or the opposite of the Canton Palace Theater screenings, where we spent like an hour and a half
just pontificating on various topics.
Yeah. So, you know, as long as we're talking, we should have announced this at the start of the show, but we're doing, the July 19th, Mark and I are going to be doing a live version of this show at the Black Forge Coffee House in Pittsburgh, PA. I don't even know the time. 7, I want to say.
Yeah, I don't know.
Doors at 7, maybe.
Yeah.
anyway, you can go on our Facebook page and find the event info, and we'll be posting about it leading up to the event in July. But we want to start mentioning it on the show now, so people have plenty of time if they want to travel to see us yammer on about the Chestnut Ridge or whatever we talk about. So I thought I better throw that in while I'm still thinking.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Okay, so conference recap.
Conference recap. Well, the MC was Tim Banal, who probably anyone listening to this show kind of knows of via his own show, Banal of America.
Yeah.
And he also is involved in Coast to Coast AM. He calls in once a week, kind of does a recap, and I think he is sort of a aggregate for stories for them. Mm-hmm. You know, he gathers them and sends them in. So the first night it was Andy, my son, he went first, then I followed, and the days leading up to that were pretty interesting. I think I heard Andy's speech probably 4 or 5 times in total, because he wanted to get it just right. And as objectively as I can, I think he, the best version is the one that he did at the conference.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It was very STM focused.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I guess I forget sometimes, like, that that's such a big piece of, like, his involvement in the field, or, like...
It really is. I mean, that's... And his presentation, like you said, it brought that to light, mm-hmm. is that, you know, he considers that his entry point into most of this, which was a lot of fun.
I'm sorry, Andy.
And he got, I think he was really encouraged by the feedback mm-hmm. that he got. After I did my presentation, then it was the keynote, Anna Nakaris, and she did a whole talk about kind of the process of discovering new species and the work that she's been involved with regard to the slow loris. And that was really pretty cool. That whole thing was very fascinating because she has actually been out numerous times in the field and, you know, doing the documentation and the work of bringing new species to light. And so she was talking about how you talk to indigenous people to get stories about real creatures that have not been identified and techniques to use while you're out just in the woods at night. And she's been all over the place. I mean, she's been in the Amazon and jungle situations and far-flung countries and so forth. So it was pretty neat to listen to her. And she's a cryptozoologist of the year last year.
Mm-hmm. Who, no one was named.
I don't think. No, it was never, never stated. Mm. No golden Yeti oh, yeah. yet. I don't know.
Yeti.
Golden Yeti. So yeah. So that was Friday night. And then, Saturday, there was, Leah Fisher. She's written a book for middle readers called The Cryptid Catcher, and she got in touch with Lauren, and he's helped kind of shape and mold her stories to be a little more fact-based as far as the cryptozoology end of things. But she's a real engaging speaker and gets asked into middle schools a lot to do a lot of speaking, and she shared that's a lot of fun because she goes there and talks about cryptozoology. A lot of times the teachers think she's going there to talk about writing, and they're in for a surprise. Following her was Ken Gerhard, and he talked at length about big birds and thunderbirds. In a way, it was kind of a good primer for those who were going to watch Terror in the Skies later in the day, because he was able to get in, you know, some of the things that you can only mention in passing in a documentary. He was able to show you all these different names for Native American terms for the Thunderbird and so forth. And he's written numerous books that all have to do with flying creatures. So he is very well versed in the subject. After Ken was Cliff Berrickman, and he had sort of a catch-all, kind of what he's been doing post-finding Bigfoot. And the big thing is that he's founding a museum in Boring, Oregon. Mm-hmm. It'll be the most exciting part of Boring.
Yo, did you hear him tell someone that Dahl is right? Yeah. It's like a neighboring town. Boring.
Yeah, right.
That's lovely.
Yeah, so he is founding the North American Bigfoot Museum mm-hmm. there in Boring, and it's in the infancy stages, and you can follow that. He's on all the social media platforms with the museum, and they're doing things now like putting in new doors and stuff, and it's really cool to watch from the ground up, and it's his life now. I mean, when you talk to him, this is really what he's doing mm-hmm. in addition to the podcast, but I think that's more for fun yeah. with Bobo, but he's putting everything now into this museum.
He went back out there to work on the museum in between the
ABC
and Maine. Yeah. Originally he was going to road trip around.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, best wishes to Cliff. I would really recommend our listeners put as much support behind that as possible, because it's hard work to do something like this. I don't, you know, he's doing it for profit, so he's going to have his hands full.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it goes. The thing that really excited me about his presentation, in addition to the museum information, was he was talking about stuff that's happening out on the Olympic Peninsula, and we have a better... appreciation for that.
That's one word for it.
Yeah. But there's been some rumblings, you know, about these nests that have been found out there. Mm-hmm. And so he had a picture of him reclining in one of the nests.
I was going to include that picture on the Trail of Bigfoot because I have that too.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so just the thing that he brought to light was that there's been some pretty interesting track finds out there and the nest finds. And those two things were happening independent of each other. And he was kind of the one thing that both of those cases had in common. And they were geographically very close to each other. So that what it suggests is sort of obvious, but that there's lots of stuff going on the Olympic Peninsula. Mm-hmm. And done in the characteristic, engaging Cliff Berrickman style. It's always fun to hear him talk. The next presentation was by gentleman named Edward Guimont, and the title of his presentation was Mokele, Mbebe, and Colonialism. And it was really a very fascinating thing because he was talking about how governments and economic policies have either opened the door to Western people to come in and sort of investigate these native tales or shut them out. And it's something that I haven't really given a whole lot of thought to before, is that just having access to that depends on forces that a lot of the time are out of people's control. And then it took a left turn into like reptilian conspiracy theories. I'm still trying to figure out exactly
it's important
how that left turn took place in the presentation, but it was all pretty interesting. And then there were a few presentations that, quite frankly, I didn't sit in on.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell you really what they were about because I was hanging out at the STM table and feverishly buying things while vendors were still there.
Yeah, we spent so much money at this event.
Yeah. Yeah.
We bought some really cool, like, little cryptid ceramic, or I don't know what they were made of, but Adrian bought Tommy a little porg. And then we bought a... she bought herself something else. I forget. I think it might've been a little champ. But we bought those. I bought comic books. I bought a hat from the Mandate 33 guys. I bought a lot of stuff at this event. And then Saturday night was the premiere.
Yes.
And then the next day was, the final two speakers, Jeff Belanger. Mm-hmm. Were you in there for that one?
No.
Okay. I didn't either. I actually would have liked to hang it. So one of the cool things for me was getting to meet and talk to Jeff, because I've actually been aware of his work in New England for years, going back to the days when I used to listen to Spooky South Coast while I worked medical billing. And so to meet him was cool. Like, I had no idea that he was like one of the lead writers on Ghost Adventures and stuff like that. So we had a long talk about like indie film and indie film distribution and stuff like that. And that was really cool. The other part we probably should mention is our Saturday evening dining experience, wherein the STM crew ordered $90 worth of Chipotle and sat at a table in the middle of the conference room while the conference was still going on around us, even though it wasn't supposed to be. We were in the vendor's room, and the vendor's room was supposed to be closed, but people were still in there. But there was something surreal and funny and heartwarming about it, too, because it was like it was all of us, but then we had Ellie and we had Alexander with us, and it was nice. Like, we all just sat there eating our $90 worth of dinner. Tommy was having a blast, and then we went in and did the premiere. Great event though. Like, I don't know if it's the fact that it's in Maine or what, but it doesn't seem like it gets enough attention. And the focus is always on these like Bigfoot conferences that take place in like Texas and Arkansas or Ohio. But this event in Maine is like one of the best, you know, like if you're a serious cryptozoology fan, like you're into the subject of cryptozoology, whether that's Bigfoot or Thunderbirds or whatever, it's probably going to be covered during this event. I mean, they have a wide range of topics, and it's not all Bigfoot and it's not all Thunderbirds and it's not all lake monsters or whatever, but you can get kind of the full scope of the subject when you come to this event. And something I had said that I online after the event that I stick to is the fact that I really feel like they strike a great balance of like it takes itself very seriously and they're very serious about the subject, but they don't take themselves too seriously. It's still fun, and there's a lot of like fun to be had at the event. It's one of a kind, honestly. I don't think there's anything else like this. So if you get the chance to visit, if they do it again next year, I really strongly recommend people, you know, plan on attending, because it's a lot of fun. And the speaker lineup this year was ridiculous. Like, I thought it was a great lineup. John Tenney was there too.
Yeah.
Super nice guy. I got to meet him, strongly recommend it.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly right. You've got sort of that balance of a real disciplined approach to the subject, but everybody's there to have fun and just enjoy the topic. And that's really nice. And the thing that I walked away with also was the sense of how wide the umbrella of what we think of as cryptozoology really is. Mm-hmm. 'Cause you had everybody there from sort of hard scientist approach and very fact-based and very reasoned. And then you have sort of the imaginative end of it as well, and the real speculative end of cryptozoology and everything in between. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until, Lauren Coleman's presentation, which is what kicked off Sunday morning, that it occurred to me, because he mentioned it, that's what he led off with, is you haven't heard about Bigfoot very much at this event. And it was true. There hadn't been any Bigfoot-centric presentations except for Cliff's, mm-hmm. but it was one of many different things. And what gets lost in the shuffle with Bigfoot and Mothman and things like that is that cryptozoology is also very interested in simply uncovering real life biological animals.
Yeah, sort of mundane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
there's nothing mundane about it, but you know what I mean?
Right. Like exactly. Yeah. And relative to these other, you know, more extreme possibilities. Mm-hmm. But that is a part of it too. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention real quick is that one of the things that makes this such a unique event is the proximity to the museum. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who's had a background or an interest in cryptozoology at all, when you go into that museum and you take the time to look around, it's just stunning. I mean, you could really spend a whole lot of time there going case to case and looking in.
We need to do an episode about the Kappa.
We do. Yeah.
Forthcoming Monsteropolis episode about the Kappa.
Yeah. Yep. But for anyone with an appreciation for the historical end of this, what Lauren Coleman has amassed there is really something very special. It can't be duplicated anywhere else.
We were asked online by Ryan Scott if we had any recording of Mark's presentation on the Peninsula Python. So we're going to have Mark kind of give his presentation right here on live on the show. So you can at least experience somewhat what the audience got to experience on Friday night. But this is going to be Mark talking about the Peninsula Python case.
From high above the valley, the Cuyahoga River resembles a giant snake winding its way through northern Summit County, slithering toward Cleveland, Ohio, and Lake Erie. It seems strangely fitting, then, that in the summer of 1944, near the end of World War II, people living and working along the banks of the Cuyahoga were startled by the appearance of a massive serpent. These sightings gave rise to the legend of the Peninsula Python. This story is unique, both in its specificity, out-of-place python stories are relatively rare in the Midwest, and the degree to which it has been embraced by local culture, including institutions such as the public library and historical society. Peninsula was incorporated in 1859. In those days, the growth of the village was directly related to the construction and operation of the Ohio and Erie Canal. The canal needed boats, so vessels were built, repaired, and stored there. In addition to agricultural items and building materials, the waterway transported numerous travelers, necessitating the opening of 5 hotels and as many as 14 saloons at once. Peninsula rapidly earned a reputation as a rough-and-tumble canal town, leavened only somewhat by the founding of several churches. Major changes to the region were wrought by the introduction of the Valley Railway in 1880. While it meant the beginning of the end for the canal, the railroad created new diverse economic opportunities for the area. Both farming and industry rose to prominence, and 4 stone quarries would remain busy until the 1920s. As time passed and more people began to travel by car, many farms were sold to those looking to leave the city. Some of these properties became housing developments or camps. By 1944, the population of Peninsula was a blend of European immigrant workers, longtime farm families, transplanted artists and writers, business executives who commuted to Akron or Cleveland, factory workers, and other blue-collar types, all attracted to the natural beauty of the Cuyahoga Valley. The idea that life in such an idyllic Western Reserve village could be interrupted by an aggressive, oversized snake would have seemed like a tall tale from canal boat days, until it happened. Almost everything known about the Peninsula Python can be attributed to Robert Bordner, a reporter and feature writer who covered the Python incident for the Cleveland Press newspaper, and wrote an article called The Peninsula Python, an Absolutely True Story, for The Atlantic the following year, November 1945. Bordner, who happened to live on a 100-acre farm on Major Road in Peninsula, had easy access to eyewitnesses and law enforcement officials who suddenly had to deal with a stupendous serpent. Bordner suggested that the python had been imported to the area and then inadvertently released. As the story goes, a circus truck got lost south of Cleveland. The driver of the truck lost control of the vehicle while going down a steep hill in Bath Township and crashed into Ira Cemetery. The driver was killed and the cargo was scattered, resulted in the escape of two large snakes. One of them was evidently found dead near Doylestown, Ohio on May 1, 1944. The August 27, 1945 edition of the Cleveland Press ran a photograph of the carcass lying in front of nine people, all of whom are named in the caption. Bordner is the author of the accompanying article. The other snake was never accounted for until, perhaps, June 1944. On June 8th, a farmer named Clarence Mitchell was tending to his fields on the west side of the river, approximately 3 miles south of Peninsula's Main Street. After commenting that his dogs had been acting strangely for a couple days, Mitchell told Bordner, "I don't know what made me look up, but there about 15 paces away was the biggest snake I ever see, sliding along easy and slow in plain sight on the bare ground. I just stood quiet, not aiming to attract attention. It seemed like 10 minutes I watched. He slid into the river, swam across, and climbed out on the other side. He was thick as my thigh right here, and every bit of 15 feet long, more like 18. Sort of brownish spotted. I went over and looked at the track. It was like you'd rolled a spare tire across my field." Within minutes, it seems, the python was seen again, this time by a farmer working on the other side of the river. The witness, Mike Bobasek, first saw Clarence Mitchell hurrying to his house and then observed the snake coming up out of the water, continuing its eastward trek. 10 days later, well-known farmers Paul and John Zale found a track resembling an auto tire winding through their newly seeded field on Akron Peninsula Road. This find is significant because the Zales were respected members of the community, and the same family continues to operate a booming fresh produce market near the location where the track was discovered. Upon being called to the scene, Peninsula Mayor John Rich declared, "Nothing but a mighty big snake could have made that track." However, the event that caused anxiety levels to skyrocket took place about a dozen days after Clarence Mitchell's initial encounter. On a Northampton Road farm, Mrs. Roy Vaughn watched as a huge serpent scaled a 3.5-foot fence. As she described it, "Right there was a great big snake trying to get through the woven wire fence, but he had a lump in him as big as a basket, and the lump wouldn't go through the fence. He reared up and climbed right over the top of that wire fence, 3.5 feet high. The last few feet of him fell over, plop, a big plop on the far side, and he went down the ravine." Within moments, Mrs. Vaughn discovered that a chicken was missing from her coop. The local population was galvanized by this act of thievery. Mayor Rich convened a search party on Sunday, June 25th, to apprehend the unwanted animal. The group that gathered in front of the barbershop was so large that Police Chief Art Huey broke them into smaller teams, and Mayor Rich wisely declared that each posse was allowed only one rifle. If someone saw the python, he was to hurry to the nearest telephone and call the West Richfield operator, who would then have 3 blasts blown on the fire siren. Every effort was to be made to take the creature alive. Fletcher Reynolds, director of the Cleveland Zoo, had let it be known that once contacted, he would be on the scene in half hour or less to collect and rehome the python. As if the atmosphere was not charged enough, Bordner reported that as the parties were making their final preparations, across the bridge into town charged 2 companies of Ohio Guardsmen, bayonets fixed. Captain William E. Morris explained that they knew nothing of the snake hunt, but had camped up on Brewery Hill overnight and were taking the town for practice. Lest this sound like a bit of embellishment, the arrival of the Ohio militia is corroborated by Edward Keenan, reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. He writes that while Captain Morris's men had no plans to join in the hunt for the snake, the commander did say, "We'd be glad to assist, however, if they run into any serious trouble." Undeterred, the python search began in earnest. The groups deployed on river bottoms, up ravines, and through the woods. Women and children watched the action from the safety of their automobiles. Reporters and photographers from the city newspapers trailed the posses in an effort to describe the pursuit to their readers. One of the reporters, Ray Mitten, wrote an entertaining account of the Sunday python hunt in which he opined the attitude that the whole thing was a lark prevailed. However, in the same article, he noted that I was in Ralph Watson's group of about 15, along with skinny, congenial Clarence Mitchell, Ira Farmer, who was the first to see the snake. "Darn right I saw it," Clarence told me, "only I didn't have my rifle along. It's about 15 feet long, I guess." Mitten also captured the most dramatic moment of the day. "Then we heard the siren, three blasts, and we started back with the working press choosing to follow the stream rather than go back over those hills. We got to the road and found our cars and started to the spot where the snake was supposed to have been seen. A guy had told the operator he was on his way to Akron when he saw it. After a score of men had combed the fields on either side of the road, it was decided the tip was a phony. And feeling much more secure out of the woods, I was about to sneer and I told you so sneer when I saw a look on Chief Huey's face that would have stopped a river of molten lava in its tracks. That snake is no joke to the peninsula folks." In the following day's Cleveland Press, Robert Bordner indicated that the false alarm call had been traced to a payphone at the Fairlawn drugstore in Akron. 2 days later, Bordner soberly announced that at a conference between Mayor Rich, Police Chief Huey, two assistant chiefs, and representatives of the Volunteer Fire Department and Civil Defense Council, all disposition to capture the reptile alive had evaporated. If the search for the python had ever been a lark, Mayor Rich was no longer amused, declaring, "We are deadly in earnest about bringing that snake in, dead or alive." As if sensing the hostility, the python made only two more notable appearances that summer. A woman named Pauline Hopko, a resident of Boston Village, had gone out to milk her cows, only to find them in an agitated state. She soon found out why. In the branches of a dead willow tree, she saw a snake with a head as big as a man's. She watched as it dropped from the tree and made its way to the river. Some reports indicate that this shocking sight caused Mrs. Hopko to faint. Members of the Python Posse, some of whom have presumably participated in the June 25th hunt, were called to the scene a few hours later, but the serpent slipped through their fingers once again. A couple days later, a man named Ernie Raymond was surprised to observe a strange stump in his field. As he approached the object, he was astounded to discover that it was a coiled python. Raymond ran to retrieve his gun, but it was too late. The creature escaped through the tall grass that could be seen parting as it left the scene. August 1944 brought no new sightings of the python. Townsfolk had time to reflect on the experience and settle on an opinion. Eyewitnesses insisted that they had seen a gargantuan snake. Those of an open-minded nature concluded that people were on edge because of the war, and that Peninsula had succumbed to a classic case of mass hysteria. Still others expressed not only skepticism but also embarrassment. Plenty of letters were published in local papers with titles like "Makes Peninsula Look Ridiculous." Some of those letters even named or blamed the man who had chronicled the Peninsula Python incident, accusing him of inventing the story to sell copies of the press. That probably reads too much into his motivation, but it does seem fair to say that he relished the opportunity to give shape to folklore that was forming in his own backyard. Robert Bordner broke the story of the python for the Cleveland Press and covered it through its duration and made regular reference to it for decades to follow in articles, columns, and interviews. He was described by writer Mark J. Price as an eccentric character who waxed his mustache, wore wire horn-rimmed glasses, smoked a corncob pipe and carried a fancy cane. He favored French berets, fur-trimmed caps, plaid shirts, denim pants, flowing scarves, and shiny spats. He projected a certain ebullience that carried through to his prose, which was undeniably lively and engaging. That spirit permeated his promotion of the region. He is credited with helping popularize Cleveland-area natural wonders like the Hinckley buzzards and woolly bear caterpillars. He also used his platform to urge the expansion of Cleveland's park system, which he feared was becoming overcrowded. His pen and persona made him quite well known by local leaders. But in the summer of 1945, with memories of the great snake hunt still fresh in the public mind, Bordner began writing about a new local legend. This story would ultimately raise indirect yet lingering questions about the Python episode that are hard for the thoughtful to shed. On August 29, 1945, Bordner wrote, "This Cuyahoga Valley village, heart of the Peninsula Python country, is buzzing today with rumors of a gold strike. Only a few people know the facts, and they won't tell. But this much is true. For months, small parties have been prospecting the hills, digging in secret, extracting samples. I have seen the pits." Predictably, gold fever hit Peninsula. Instead of discouraging enterprising prospectors, the police chief and his assistant officers led the charge to discover the lost treasure, with divining rods at the ready. With every new article Bordner published, more people picked up shovels and pickaxes and took to the hills. The exuberant reporter clearly delighted in parceling out information, such as locations and legends pertinent to the search. One of his stories told of Mulehead Mulligan, an Irish lock digger who allegedly stole from his cholera-sickened co-workers and hid the proceeds somewhere in the Ohio and Erie Canal, specifically under Old Wallace Lock, also known as Lock Number 33. The level of detail provided in such clues inspired locals and visitors alike to try their hand at recovering a fortune. However, their hopeful efforts consistently yielded the same result: nothing. That is, until an old safe was recovered from Peninsula's swimming quarry. As Bordner wrote in the September 17, 1945 edition of the Cleveland Press, "Diving operations brought up the steel box from exactly the spot where the divining rods of the Peninsula gold hunters indicated precious metal to lie. The tight little fraternity of gold hunters were answering no questions." Around the same time, thousands of dollars of old-time currency began to circulate through the businesses of Peninsula, according to Akron Beacon Journal reporter Don R. Klein. The finger of suspicion pointed in the direction of Chief Art Huey to the degree that Mayor John Rich declared, "If all this old money you men are passing in Peninsula, Boston, and Richfield comes from the safe you recovered from the quarry, it is incumbent upon me to request your resignation." Huey denied any wrongdoing and confidently stated that the old money now in circulation is not part of that recovered from the stolen safe. Sensing that things had gone too far, Bordner intervened, admitting that the story of buried treasure was a hoax. Or, as he told Akron Beacon Journal writer Don Klein on September 21st, "just a beautiful story." He had sent a letter to Assistant Chief Dale Hall with a tip about the submerged safe, and had withdrawn old currency from the Cleveland Reserve Bank in order to plant it in local businesses. The confession provoked an angry reaction in Peninsula, with residents calling for the resignation of their police force. Regarding his part in the proceedings, Bordner simply said, "It's been a lot of fun," even as letters to the Beacon Journal called for the removal of his column from the paper. The strange saga of the gold hoax raised obvious questions about Bordner's veracity. Many considered it to be a tacit admission that the Peninsula Python was simply an earlier beautiful story concocted by a writer overeager to promote his village. That may indeed have been the case. Yet, there are some facts that warrant consideration before we consign the Python to the category of fanciful yarn. When pressed, Bordner always maintained that he sincerely believed there was a large snake in the vicinity of Peninsula in the summer of 1944. That, of course, hardly proves the existence of the reptile, and his reference to the python's presence as a good story, too, seems deliberately ambiguous. Yet, he demonstrated he was capable of admitting a hoax, and he had every opportunity to clean the slate in September of 1945. That
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM, or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.
In unusual cases, the eyewitness testimony is compelling. Without exception, those who claimed to see the serpent were people well acquainted with agrarian life, in tune with the flora and fauna of the outdoors, and would not be prone to misidentify a common snake. Moreover, these were people who looked to keep others off their land. Inviting a posse of snake hunters into their carefully cultivated fields would not have been on their agenda. Most significantly, Bordner is not the exclusive source of eyewitness information. Ray Mitten corroborated the story of Clarence Mitchell, the first eyewitness, who was insistent that he had seen a snake at least 15 feet in length, and Mitten's report places Mitchell at the site of the snake hunt on June 25, 1944. Additionally, a reporter named Mary Louise Donnelly, writing for the Hudson, Ohio Times, gained the admission of employees of the Cole Brothers Circus that they had lost not one, but two pythons south of Akron in spring of 1944. If accurate, this opens the door to the possibility that two exotic snakes were on the loose in northeast Ohio at the precise time necessary for one to be found dead in Doylestown in May of 1944, and the other to launch a legend in Peninsula in June of the same year. One of the greatest twists in this tale is that Robert Bordner not only survived the gold hoax scandal, but also exerted a lasting influence on Peninsula in a significantly positive manner. Following the suggestion of local artist Honoré Gilbo Cook, the Peninsula Library and Historical Society opened in 1943. Bordner, Cook's neighbor, became the library's first president and championed its cause for the rest of his life. Along with his wife, Eunice Merton Bordner, Robert served closely with Cook in support of the library, and their partnership resulted in an artistic legacy which continues to beautify the community while memorializing the python story. In 1964, Cook designed the mural of transportation into the valley, which adorns the front of the library. It depicts the serpentine shape of the Cuyahoga River from an aerial perspective, and on an interior wall of the library, one finds her mural titled Peninsula Python, which was completed in 1970. Inventively, using actual newspaper accounts, Cook tells the entire story of the snake on one large panel, even incorporating a few buzzards as a knowing nod to her friend Bob. Adjacent to the Peninsula Python mural, one finds a plaque that reads, "As an institution is the lengthened shadow of one man, so this building is that of Robert Bordner." In Peninsula, Ohio, Robert Bordner's love of a beautiful story endures.
Nice. Nice. I'm glad I got to catch a lot of that, because I missed large chunks when we were actually in Maine. Great story. And for those that don't know, there's a Peninsula Python Days in Peninsula, Ohio, and you can come down and visit. At some point, I'm going to attempt to go. I think every year so far, I've been doing something else on the day of the event.
Yeah, it's typically in June.
Yeah.
And there's a parade.
Gone every weekend in June
this year. Yeah, there's a weather-permitting parade. I guess the big python that they have is paper mache.
Nice.
So it's if like it rains,
like
it would
all. Chinese dragon.
Yeah, yeah.
So, we'll be back next week to talk about black helicopters, which also relates to an incident that happened during the trek to Maine. Don't forget about the event on July 19th in Pittsburgh. Put it in your calendar and come hang out with us. Listen to us do a live version of this very show. And I can't think of anything else. So leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Be back next time. Thank you.